Alan Crane Productions, in association with the Emergent Life Studio, present the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for autumn semester 2025. Today, Foundations of Finance. And as I had told you in the first lecture, every day we begin with a look at the numbers. Now, in the first few of these, I will be covering broad visual concepts in these numbers that I show you. And I will be doing this every day of the semester. And I quite expect you not to be able to get all of the terminology down in the first time you see it. This is just like learning a new language. You start by catching this word and that word out there, and slowly you begin to develop a fluency. And like I said, I don't expect you to know what I'm saying, a lot of it, the first couple of times, maybe the first four or five times. But it does sink into you, and this is part of one of my objectives in the course, is to make you able to make your own investment decisions without the need to run to some investment guru on the internet, on a blog, or on some TV show. You can look at the numbers yourself, know what they're saying, and understand what their meaning is, and do so objectively without a lot of opinions and self-styled ideas getting in the way. Now, the first thing, that's actually too big right now. Let me kind of back that down a little bit. There we go. I hope you can still see that. First things first, a day where stocks are going up, we call a bull or a bullish day. A day when stocks are going down is a bear or a bearish day. You can be bullish on an entire market, or you can be bullish on a stock. You might be bullish on a stock, but bearish on the market. Green is up, red is down. Now, don't get the impression that if it's red, it's a bear day, I'm going to lose money. Because it's your fault if you lose money in a bear market. Because you can make money in a bear market just as well as you can make money in a bull market. The next thing that I need to go through is this term market. When I say a market, there are many different kinds of markets, and I can even divide them up. There are physical markets versus financial markets. That's the first way I can divide them up. Now, in the financial markets, there are all kinds of subcategories. There are stocks, there are bonds. You can talk about derivatives, like call options, put options, futures. And then there are other kinds of animals, ETFs, which are sort of like stocks, mutual funds, which are sort of like ETFs, but not quite, and other exotica down the line here of financial markets. Primarily, I will focus in this class on stocks and bonds, although I will get into another kind of market where you have commodities. Now, these are physical things, but for our purposes, they're nothing but financial instruments. Gold, silver, copper, such animals as that. Oil, and I will talk about those, but primarily this is about stocks and bonds. Breaking it down another way, an exchange is where multiple stocks are bought and sold. Now, in this regard, there are physical platforms, physical exchanges, where you've probably seen, those are the ones you most probably likely think about, the ones where you see this giant trading floor and there's yelling and farting and throwing papers around, and that is a physical exchange. A good example of that would be the New York Stock Exchange. There are, however, purely electronic exchanges where there is no physical place. When I had a penny stock house, it was all on computer terminals. This was back before most people even knew what a computer was. And it's still around. The best example is the National Association of Securities Dealers Automated Quotes or Quotations, NASDAQ. That's an electronic exchange. Now, the NYSE is huge companies, big, big companies of the earth. You can always tell that it's a company traded on the New York Stock Exchange because it has one, two, or three letters in its trading symbol. IBM, MMM, those kinds of companies. Ford, F, General Motors, GM, Pfizer, PFE. Those would be NYSEs. Electronics, the NASDAQ is mostly small cap, scrappy, high risk companies. Interestingly, there are a few giants on the NASDAQ. That's where they started when they were little and they just stayed there. Microsoft, MSFT, Amazon, AMZN, Tesla, TSLA. They are four letter, but they never went over to the New York Stock Exchange. Now, the term exchange, more generally, in other countries, you would hear them called bourses, a bourse. So there is a Zurich bourse, there's a London bourse, there's a Hong Kong bourse, there's a Tokyo bourse, Australian. But they're exchanges. That's just they use a different terminology for it. Now, distinguish that from an index. An index is a theoretical portfolio of some stocks that are representative of a larger exchange, for example. So if you look at these numbers right here that I'm showing you right off the bat here, let me turn this off here. Get serious with the work of the day. If you look at those numbers, markets overview. Now, this is Yahoo. Yahoo is not great, but it's free. I can't take you into an actual paywall platform like my accounts because then you could see my account number and you'd go crazy hacking my buys and sells. So I have to use one that's open. But look here. See how I can see the Dow 30. That is an index portfolio. That's 30 stocks, and you take their average, maybe a weighted average, and you see what it does. Those 30 stocks are of the largest companies of the world. So the movements of this index portfolio are telling us what the current sentiment is about what the economy is going, how it's going to impact them. If I look here, the Standard & Poor's 500, those are 500 very large companies. Taken together, they constitute maybe, I don't know, about 65% of the entire world's value in those 500 companies. So they are more like measuring the pulse of the whole world, what the reactions of the trading environment are to what's going on in the world itself. Now, if you the Dow 30, these are super safe stocks, low-risk stocks. So they're talking about a limited sector of the economy. Now, the last one, the NASDAQ, that one is an exchange. That's taking all of the stocks of the NASDAQ and getting their average or their weighted average. So, the next thing. (Clears throat) is the world. Believe it or not, we are not the only place in the world. And everything that we do is measured against the world. Despite the fact that the current leaders in Washington want us to close off everything and we can take care of ourselves, the rest of the world can go to hell. It isn't going to do that because the entire world is integrated too much. So we need to be able to look at these other places on Earth. So, for example, I can look at, I'm going to have to take this down a notch. Oh, come on. I'll have to take it down another notch. No, that way. There we go. Nope, I have to do that. So let me tell you the story of the clock of the world. Last night, while we were all in bed enjoying our dreams and hopes, Tokyo was awake, the sun was up, and the exchange was trading. Now, as you can see here, the Nikkei 225 is 225 representative stocks of the entire vast Tokyo exchange. And whither goes this index? That's a good measure of what the entire exchange did for the day. And as you can see, the exchange was in a pissy mood. It was a bearish day. But there's something else going on here. The prices of securities, stocks, bonds, and all that, move on the information that has just happened. They absorb it, they digest it, and then they move on. What happened 2 hours ago, even 10 minutes ago, means nothing. So if you think, as these chartists do, well, we'll look at the historical stock chart, it's meaningless because you have literally hundreds of thousands of the most informed traders on the planet driving forward with each bit of information as it comes in. They're pushing the stock price up and or down by the second. And so that idea of an equilibrium price is kind of a myth. And what happened here was that the Nikkei was dropping in its early trading. You see that in the spark chart, how it was dropping downward? That would have been pulses of bad information, information that was negative, coming through, pushing the stock traders to sell stock, drive it down. But then, at some point, there was no more. And then the stock just floated by inertia. It didn't have any other really strong pushing up or down, so it just drifted from there. It had absorbed the bad information, and now it was waiting for its next tidbit. And nothing really big, one way or the other, came through. Now we go over here, and the sun began to set in Tokyo. And as that happened, it moved across Asia, landed Asia, and then into Eastern and Central Europe. And then the sun rose and the European bourses began to wake up. Now this is sort of, this one, I thought this used to be called something else, but now it's got a name, Euro. This is sort of like a collection of stocks from the different bourses around the European European Union. And it gives you sort of a pulse of Europe, the Eurozone. And as you can see, it started out bad, dropped, it was down on the opening bell, and then the bulls finally got it to push up, but the bears took hold near the end and they knocked it back down. Okay, good. Then as the sun was getting lower in the sky in Europe, it opened up in London. This is the Financial Times 100. Again, that's an index. You see a number, that's an index. And as you can see, they were jolly good today. They were bullish all day long. Good news, good news, good news, kept pumping the price upward, upward. And at the end of the day, the trading is closed there now. It's good. Actually, I think trading is closed. Yeah, trading is even closed here now. But at the end of the day, it was up for the day. It was a bullish day. So now we come over here, and the sunset in London came across the Atlantic and rising as it was rising over here on the East Coast, our markets woke up. And we see these stocks and bonds that are the ones we would recognize beginning to trade. Good news. It was, as you can see, it's first of all, we don't care about actual numbers, the dollars and cents. That means nothing to us. It is the percentage changes that matter. Think about it this way. If you've got a $10 stock and it goes up by a dollar, that's a hell of a good return. That's 10%. But if you've got a $100 stock that goes up by a dollar, that's just a 1% rise. We can't care about the absolute numbers. All we care about are the percentages. So you get these talking heads on the news, the Dow went down 4,000 points today. Well, what was that as a percentage? That was 0.5%. Yeah, see, it doesn't mean anything. You got to look at the percentage changes to know what really happened. And in this case, the Dow is very low risk stocks. They're pussycat stocks. They're very safe. And if you look at them, they were up a measly 0.04%. I mean, anything less on either side, up or down, less than maybe about 0.20, 0.25% is really kind of the day was a wash. Nothing really active. So, and then you see that the S&P 500, which has, those stocks are riskier, it reacted more to whatever news was out there. And you can see that the S&P 500 was down about 0.25%. Okay, fine. And the NASDAQ, which is the riskiest stock, so they are the most reactive, up or down, it was down the most, down 0.2%. Okay? This is some of the basics of reading those numbers on there. These are the broad indexes. And yes, you can trade on index portfolios. There are ways that you can actually, you can invest in all 500 stocks of the Standard & Poor's 500. If you did that one stock at a time, it would cost you a literal fortune. But there are ways that you can do it for $500, $600. You can own the whole portfolio of all 500 stocks. And that's something that we strongly encourage investors to consider. Instead of buying individual stocks, buy the index portfolios. And the best way to do that is through what are called ETFs. I'll get into that in a lot more detail as the course goes along. Now I'm going to look at the crude market, or rather the commodities market. Commodities like oil, copper, silver, gold. And looking first at crude, oil is not one thing. Oil is, there are a lot of different grades of oil. Now, I was in the oil and gas business maybe 40 years ago. No, more, well, 35 years ago as part of a wildcat operation. What we pulled out of the patch was this sour sludge. It stunk like dead dinosaur farts, and it was hot, and it was miserable. Crude, that's sour crude. Then you go through better and better grades up to what we would consider to be the light sweet. The benchmark of the light sweets is Brent. And it's always going to be a little more expensive on average than the overall crude markets on average. So we see that crude right now was rising today, but it's at $62.94. Now the crude markets don't work on the clock of stocks. They have their own clocks. There's about a four-hour rest period, and it's different for different commodities. You see that Brent followed it up, as you can see. Now, here's the thing. This is unusually low for oil. Yay, low oil, low gas prices. Well, the first thing that to consider is that oil pulled out of the ground is not used just for gasoline. About 50% of oil is cracked in the cracking towers. You might have seen the ones up toward Joliet. There's one, I think it's on 55 or something. Yeah, it's cracked all the way up. Most of it, about half of it, is brought up to the level of gasoline. And then you've got those sub-levels of the 87, 89, and 93, which really doesn't mean much. People think it does, but it doesn't. But okay, then down below that is about 25% is used for what are called distillates. Distillates are like diesel, jet fuel, kerosene. And then the rest, the dregs, as some people used to call it, I don't know if they call it that now, the dregs is used, maybe 15-20%, is used for everything from asphalt to cosmetics to plastics, you name it. That is, it's used for all these products that you use, and even if you think, well, I got no carbon footprint, you put on makeup, you drive on an asphalt road, you have a carbon footprint. Now, another thing before I go on, to make sure you understand that the world lives on oil. It's been running the show for about 150 years, and it is not going away. You take those wind turbines, the materials come from hydrocarbons, from oil, and from oil. The asphalt on the roads to those wind turbines, the stuff that is put into the ground 12 feet deep for the base of them, that's hydrocarbon products. Everything that we do is somehow caught up in the flow of oil. And it's going to be that way for another 100 years. The problem with it is that we're going to run out of oil before 100 years. What will happen is it will be harder and harder to get to what oil is left. That means that we are going to tear up environmentally sensitive areas of land and down in the oceans, and still we won't get it all in time for oil to run out. That's going to be one of those things that those naysayers about peak oil, they are finally going to shut their pie holes in about 40 years. But it'll take that long for us to realize, hell, it's really going to be costly to get that oil out of that mess down there underground in Eastern Europe, or we're going to really have to just clear out all that pretty land that we've got in that protected environmental reserve. We're just going to have to tear it all down to get to the oil in there because we need it that badly. And if you've got a solution, bring it. We've got to figure out something because it's unsustainable the way it is right now down the road. Now, let me give you the other side of it. Oil prices are low right now. Yay, gasoline is low priced. That's great. No, it's not. Not as great as you think it is. Well, hey, oil is $100 a barrel. Well, that is going to make the oil men happy and the land men. No, it won't. Here's the thing. If oil prices are too low, what's going to happen is that you are going to have the riggers, the land men, the wildcatters. We're not going to go in the fields. We're not going to go and get that oil, because it's not worth it for us to. Oil prices get this low, you start having all of those families and those workers out there in the oil patch going bankrupt, leaving their homes, going to find something else to do with their lives if they don't shoot themselves. That's not a good thing. It's great for your gas tank, it's terrible for the industry, and then it will take years to recover all those people and get a whole new bunch of suckers to go out there into the fields. Okay, let's take the other side of it. Suppose oil gets to $90 a barrel. Everyone and his mother is going to stake a lease claim out there, and it's going to be over in the other side of the world where all these oil-producing countries have these agreements on how much each one produces. Well, they're just going to start violating those agreements, and they're going to turn their spigots on full blast because they can get so much money for their oil, and then you'll get a glut of oil on the market, and then you're back on the other side, glut of oil, the prices collapse, and then no one's digging again. This is the boom-bust cycle of the oil industry. The sweet spot I don't know, maybe about $75 to $85 a barrel. That's about the sweet spot. We've got kind of, there's enough price that everyone can stay in business, but it's not so good that you get idiots out there punching wells and taking leases out and all that kind of stuff and calling themselves landmen. By the way, there's a series on TV. If you're interested in that business, the series Landman is really, in some ways, it's a little exaggerated, but in other ways, it is so dead on to what I experienced. And I can't remember the star of that show, but it's a great show if you're interested in oil. Now let's get on to gold and silver. They're copper, gold, and silver, classic commodities. The problem with gold is that, look, all of these commodities, the prices that you see are driven by supply and demand dynamics. What that means is that the demand, the supply, there's a price where the amount being supplied is cleared by the amount being demanded. It changes from day to day, actually from hour to hour, minute to minute. However, gold is a little weird. Let's take silver. Silver is used for industrial purposes and for cosmetic purposes. And you know, you've got silver in a lot of the industrial things, but it's also used for jewelry, and it's also used for nice sterling silver tea sets and all that. It's supply and demand purely driving the price up and down. Gold, and so the same is true for copper too. Gold has a nasty clientele. It's got the usual supply and demand forces, you know, for industrial and cosmetic uses. However, it also has this crazy ass bunch of speculators. Whenever they think the world is going to end, they start buying gold and they drive the price up, put it under their mattress, get their AR-15 out, and wait for the government to come and take their land. And then when it doesn't happen, they go and sell their gold, and the price just drops through the floor again. So it's like normal commodities, except it is magnified by these hoe handles who make the price go up and down all the time. And you want to say, will you stop it doing that? But they kind of have guns, and they use them. So you can't, yeah, so in other words, gold, see the behaviors of those commodities, see especially gold and silver, you see how they are kind of the same, they have that same profile from day to day, except that sometimes that gold just goes apeshit. And what the hell? Yeah, I heard that the government's going to collapse tomorrow. Oh, you did? Where did you hear that from? On the internet? Ah, good. Anyway, so... Not much I can say for that, but later in the course, I will teach you how to read currency screens. And those are really important for putting our pulse on the world. Notwithstanding this weird belief that we can close off the rest of the world and we'll be okay, and you know, we can take care of them, do everything ourselves, we're connected. It's all a living economic unit. And so we have to deal with that reality and look at how, and those currency exchange rates tell us the market's expectations about the strength of the economies relative to each other. So I can look at the euro versus the USD, the United States dollar, and I can get, and as that moves, I get a window on what the best traders and minds in the world are thinking is going to be the relative prospects, economic development, interest rates, inflation. We can see those through a dark window, through a dark crystal ball, through those exchange rates. So I will show you how to look at those. It's inexact because those things are, speculators are doing stuff all the time with those exchange rates. But still, there's an underlying whisper of truth behind what they're doing. And then finally, I will teach you about bonds. Bond prices and bond interest rates are mathematically inversely related. So if some benchmark bond that kind of represents overall interest rates goes up in price, it then means that it is going down in yield, in interest rate. So as price, and this is what's weird here, is that Yahoo gives most of these in yields, but it gives the most important one in price. So I don't know what they're thinking doing that. But one way or the other, interest rates, we're looking at the interest rate environment. And as interest rates go down, in other words, as investors buy bonds, pushing their price up, that naturally pushes their yields down. That is good for the economy. Lower interest rates stimulate business activity. They stimulate consumer borrowing, all those good things. On the downside, if those are going down for the wrong reasons, ultimately what they're saying is that we are going to have an explosion of inflation down the road. If they're not going down because of market conditions, they're going down because the Fed is printing too much money. And when Fed prints too much money, we have a burst of inflation. That's why we had the inflation in the 2022 to 2023. It was because the Fed had printed a lot of money. First, under pressure by the president who was still in power in 2020, he wanted to juice the economy. He wanted printed money so that he would win re-election. But then the second round of printing money came because we had the lockdown and the government was just printing money to keep people from getting kicked out of their houses, from getting businesses going into bankruptcy. So we had two rounds of printing money that caused a big flare of inflation. And then the Fed cooled it off by cutting back on that money. And now we have an administration that is threatening to fire the Fed chairman if he doesn't start printing money again to drive down interest rates to make people happy. We'll see how that plays out. Now, the next part of this that I'm going to take you into is, generally speaking, make sure that you understand these. And I'm going to use these words over and over, and I'll define them over and over, and I'll explain them so that it sinks into you and becomes baked into your thinking patterns. Now I need to go to the next part of this. These are the overall markets, but most people think of stock markets as stocks, individual stocks. And that's where we come to the place where we get granular. We look at stocks themselves, and we look at the numbers for a stock. And I can guarantee you that by the end of this semester, you will be able to look at those numbers, and you really won't need a lot of advice. You can see for yourself what's going on with these stocks. So to do this, we're going to look at a few stocks. And if anyone says, do Tesla, I will eat your head. Let us Netflix and chill. Lol. Geez. What the heck? Okay, that's one share of Netflix. Now, you might want to check under the seat of your car to see if you got enough. One share is $1,200 for a streaming service with lousy programs, and they canceled Shadow and Bone, and I will never forgive them for that. But anyway, let's see. Okay, now let's look at the numbers. No, I'm not going to do that. That one's just stupid. Let me do cat. Caterpillar is an interesting animal. It's trading at $420.59 a share. Notice that the market has closed. It was up for the day $4.50. I don't care about that. What I care about is that it was up more than 1%. That's decent for the day. But you notice the aftermarket. This is where traders are trading, but it's not reflected in the official price. And it is the bears are kind of, they're grabbing a little bit now, selling into profit taking at that, as it were, and all of that. So if you look at CAT here, the first thing that I want you to know is that the previous close, that would have been yesterday's close. When the bell closing, ding, 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 it closed at 416.09. By this morning, when the sun, when the bell rang, it was opened lower at 4:14 and 80 cents or whatever that is. Here's what happened. At the closing bell, that 4:16:09 was the last recorded trade on the open order limit book that all traders have. That was the last one anyone did. Okay. After that, the aftermarket took over. There were buy orders, sell orders, and then in the pre-market, for a few hours, there were buy and sell orders. What happens is that the accumulation of those buy and sell orders suddenly get filled when the bell opens. It's a process over a period of maybe about a couple of minutes as liquidity builds with the market makers. The books are cleared. What would have happened in this case is that there would have been more sell orders clearing than buy orders. So you would have seen this, it looks like a just boom, like that. Because as those overnight and before market orders were put together, there was more bear action than bull action, and so it opens at a lower price. That's how this works. Now the bid and the ask. The bid here for $420 on the button. That is what you could sell a share of Netflix at. Caterpillar.
Yeah.
Will you stop correcting me when you're right? Okay, now, if you want to buy a share of Netflix, you will pay $422.69. That means a bid-ask spread is $2.29. And you're saying, now, wait a minute, fat boy. What are you talking about? You're saying that if I buy it, I have to buy it at a higher price than if I sell it? Well, spank me Jesus. That's the difference between wholesale and retail. If I buy, when I was a trader, a broker, I buy a share from you, I'm going to need to sell it to someone else at a higher price if I'm going to make some scratch on it. That's just the reality of it. That's why there's a bid-ask spread. I have to have something. You buy a share of stock from me. Well, if you say, my bad, I got to sell that. 2 seconds later, I'm going to say, okay, I'll buy it back at a lower price. And you say, you running capitalist dog, you. Yeah, I am. Because I want to have that thing, you know, like make money in what I'm doing. That's how it's done. The spread between the bid and the ask. Now, that spread gets tighter if you've got a lot of trading volume on a given day because I don't have to make as much per swing to make my coin for the day and buy the Grand Slam breakfast at Denny's after work. So, in other words, heavy volume will tend to narrow the bid-ask spread. It's not a rock-solid rule, but if there's light volume, that will tend to mean that I have to make more on each trade swing, as we call it, to get enough, you know, for myself. So if I look down here, now that on a stock in the 400 range, that's actually a fairly tight bid-ask spread because that's really only about 5% of the price of the mark. Now the days range, let's look down here. Yeah, sure enough, see the volume? The average volume would be over the past 365 days, how much per day was sold on average. As you can see, that's well below what was traded today. You see it? About, what was it? About 2.8 million shares of CAT on a typical day over the last year. Today, 4 million shares. So yeah, that higher volume means that the bid-ask spread can be a lot tighter than it would otherwise be on this. Now the next thing to look at. We are going to look at market cap. That is the price per share times the number of shares outstanding. It is the market's assessment of the value of the shareholder's equity. Price per share times the number of shares outstanding. And I will tighten these definitions up. Again, You're going to see this pattern. I use a lot of terminology just to get you used to it before I get really formal. When you're learning a language, you don't say, as a two-year-old, what is the definition of mommy? You just know what mommy is. What is the definition of diaper? You know what it is. And so that's what I do in a class, in my classes. I tighten up over time. But first, let's just use a terminology. This is the total value of shareholder equity, the ownership value of Caterpillar is about almost $200 billion. Now, interestingly, I can show you that on the financial statements, the accounting shareholder, total shareholder equity, is nowhere near this. Those two numbers are never in agreement because the accountants are not looking at the market. They're looking at book values, which mean nothing to us in our business. We don't care about what you paid for something. We care about what it's worth now. We don't care about historical costs. That's all accountants care about, is historical costs. We don't care about sunk costs. Well, when I was a consultant, I said, are we going to go to the next phase? You wouldn't believe the number of these people at the top in the C-suite who said, well, we've already put $3.7 million into this. You know where that $3.7 million is? Well, let me do it this way. Let's try it this way. You spent on a stock, I got to pick on everyone in here, but I'll pick on the first one. You, madam, you bought a stock for $100 and now it's worth $10. And you say, what do I do with it? And I said, well, you know, what do you want to do? What's your goal? Well, I want to make back my $100. And you know what? I'm going to say this to you. You know where your $100 is? It's with Jesus. It died. It went to heaven. It's not there. You go to I go to my brother's grave. He's not there. He's in hell. He gave me wedgies. Okay. I reported that to St. Peter. Okay, you understand that the history doesn't matter to us in finance. We are not a part of accounting. We are part of economics. We are a sub-discipline of economics. Don't let anyone convince you, and don't let you ever be in an accounting course where they say, we're going to teach you finance. They try that all the time, and it just bunches my boxers. They do things differently. We are market oriented. If you are in a situation, let's try this. You, madam, you have taken a safari. You're going out on the Serengeti, and you've got your field guide to animals of the Serengeti, and you see this lion, and it's looking at you. And it starts running, kaloom, kaloom, yum, kaloom, dinner, kaloom. And you open your field guide and it says, lions really are no threat to humans whatsoever. They can even be made into pets. They are just big, cute, cuddly kitties. So you look at the field guide and then you look at this thing coming at you with a dinner knife and its dinner fork out. Which are you going to believe? What you see the market telling you, or what the accountants are telling you in a book? You're going to believe what you see in front of you. That's why we can't give a rat's ass about what the accountants say. We've got to look at what the market says, because you're going to buy that stock from a market participant. You're not going to call the accountant and say, hi, I'd like to buy a share of stock. He's going to say, what? You're going to buy it from those predators out there. And trust me when I tell you about this. I was in this business for a long time. You think that you are out there and it's a fair game? No, it's not. I am trading to take your lunch money away from you. And if you're stupid enough to let me sucker you into it, well, then I'll take your retirement money. And you'll die alone in an alley. And I won't care because you bought me another martini at my lunch on Wall Street. That's how predatory we are. We don't care about all those sentiments and feelings and opinions and judgments. We look at the hard data. Data over desires, data over dogma, data over your opinions. That's all that matters in our markets. Now understand this about stocks, before I go on and show you the rest of these numbers here, is that no stock is at its true value. There really is an underlying intrinsic price of a stock. What is the present value of the future expected cash flows divided by the number of shares outstanding? There really is that, but we cannot see it ever. What we can see is just what the information of the moment is telling us. And the truth of the matter is that it turns out that you, sir, you're my son.
Awesome.
Yeah, I know, right? I have regrets. That night was one. But you see, I look at you on any given day, and I see, oh God, you are such a disappointment to me, you know? And I'm so old, and you're never going to be anything. I'm so old, I went into an antique shop, and someone tried to buy me. But then there are other days when, oh my God, he's the greatest kid on earth. I mean, he's the next captain of the universe. But the truth is of the matter is that you're somewhere in between those. There is a true you. I'm not going to see it on any given day. I'm going to see you as some shining knight, or I'm going to see you as a disgusting slob, but it's not the you. And that's the way it is with stocks. We see their price on any given day, but that is not the intrinsic price. Sometimes a stock is overvalued, sometimes it's undervalued. And that valuation, that misevaluation, can persist for minutes, days, years. So just because I know that it is overvalued doesn't mean that the stock price is going to drop tomorrow. There are some, I will show you some here in just a minute, that are classic examples where you have this disequilibrium that holds it above intrinsic value for a long time. And I can even tell you in some cases why it's that way. But in this case, what are we looking at here? The first thing is EPS, earnings per share. If it's positive, well, earnings per share is just your total profit divided by your number of shares. So if that's positive, you've got it's a profitable company, earnings per share. So we know that CAT is profitable. And it pays a dividend, that's nice. But here's the ones that I want you to key on right now. First one is beta. Beta is, you're going to learn a lot about beta. And there's formulas, and beta is a formula itself. Beta is used in formula. It is the way we measure risk of a security in our world. Beta. Now, a beta of 1 would be the risk of the world portfolio. A beta of 1 would be the risk of the world portfolio. In other words, if you took every stock on earth and made a portfolio out of them, that would have a beta of 1. Now, a beta of 0 says that there's no risk in this at all. This, like, for example, a treasury bill has really no risk. It's got a beta of 0. A lot of bonds actually have very low betas, maybe 0.1, 0.15, because bonds are a lot safer than stocks in general. Okay, good news. So, what are we talking about? Above one, you have what we call a risky stock. Some you might call it an aggressive investment, a speculative investment. We use all kinds of nice terms, but all we're really saying is it's risky. If you've got a stock between 0 and 1, we say that's a defensive investment or a conservative investment. So we see that CAT has a beta of 1.4. That's getting up there into really risky territory. Put another way, this is no place for beginners to start. This is a very risky company. Make no mistake about it. Well, Caterpillar, it's a long-standing company. Doesn't matter. If you look at its data, the data is telling you, watch it. This is not a stock if you want to not lose your shorts. With a beta of 1.4, you could make a lot of money, but you could also take a butt bath with the stock. Now, the next one is the PE ratio, price to earnings. This one is a window on over or undervaluation. Now, I use the number 30, and you'll have others, 35, 40, 25. But a price to earnings, if it's above, let's in my judgment, if it's above, much above 30, it's an overvalued stock. That price divided by the earnings is too high. If it's below 30, then that means the price is too low compared to the earnings, and so it's undervalued. And these can persist for a long time. You can have something undervalued for like months, in some cases years, and it just stays there. But we do consider those to be more prospective investments. Now, this one is tricky, though, because you've got a stock that is undervalued. But at the same time, this stock is risky AF. So you're taking a big risk, but you have this pretty good idea that eventually its price is going to go up because right now it's below intrinsic value. Now let me go over here, and just for shots and giggles, I'm going to do that company that is led by he of the cloven hoof, Elon Musk. Tesla. And I'm going to dispense with anything, jokes about Elon, and we're just going to go down here, and I want you to look at the beta and the PE. The beta and the PE. Start with the beta. Remember what I told you. What do you see about that beta, sir? Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, you said 1.4 was terrible. This is at 2.33.
Well, I wouldn't say terrible. It's just, you know, if you're into things like taking, you know, shots of the Scottish whiskey that I drank, it's just ridiculous. It is. You're right. It's definitely not an amateur stock. Well, I believe in Elon. He's my kind of bro. I bet we could drink beer together. I'm going to buy his stock. Like hell you should. This is a pro stock. This is the kind of stuff where you have enough money that you can lose all of it investing in a stock like this. Even CAT is risky. This thing is risky AF. That's professional language. Okay, now look at the PE ratio. What would you say about the PE ratio? What is it telling us about the price of that stock? What do you see? Anything? Go ahead, my son.
Super overvalued.
So, yeah, it is so overvalued. It's about six times overvalued. That's insane. Will it fall tomorrow? No. Will it fall this year? Absolutely not. Go.
So what would be a good PE ratio to be at?
I would, if I'm going to be buying stocks, I would look for something well below 20, well below 30. If I'm looking to get rid of something, I'd look for something well above 30, case in point. But in a case like this, it's going to stay way overvalued because there was so vast an investment by the heavies on Wall Street early on that they can't afford to bail. Because if they start getting out of the stock price is going to crash, and on Wall Street, it's called, some of you may have already heard this term, marking to market on your financial statements. You have to mark what the market price is, not what you bought it at. So in a case like that, if you mark to market and the price collapses, you've basically made your brokerage house insolvent. So those heavies on Wall Street that put all that money in and they keep pouring more money in, and the banks in Europe that are pouring money in, and the trust funds and the banks in the United States that poured all that money in, they can't have this stock price fall. So when it starts to try to find intrinsic value, you better believe you just can see it in the limit order books. The buy orders come in, and they come in from the usual suspects. All of those places that can't afford to let that price fall. So when the sell orders start trying to pile up to get it back to intrinsic value, they come in and they buy the heck out of it. So there is a back story to all of this. And so playing it from this front end where you're looking at charts of historical data and all that, that's not telling you anything. It's like you hear thunder and you say, well, I hear that thunder. That must be the god named Thor rolling his tater wagon across the sky. Go up there and look. You will see there is no Thor. There is no magic. It is pure physics, and that's all, mathematics. And that's what we have here. We have a world of people out there who believe all of these things that are magical, and but if you get inside, you see that it is all explainable. It's easy to explain. And so that's where I try to take you in a course like this, and in other courses that you'll face from other professors. We're trying to take you away from the world of magic and beliefs and bring you into the world of best practices, mathematics, formulas, and good sound judgment based upon rational data. I am so over you today. Go home.